everyone. I'm Jo. Welcome back to Looking Outside. Today on the show, we're exploring value, data, ownership, all the rich areas in between. How is value defined? What value is extrinsic versus intrinsic? And how we may change our transaction with value using current and emerging economic systems. So really meaty topic. Definitely going to be an interesting one to dive into. So of course, for this, I had to bring in an expert on this conversation. So a huge welcome to the show, to Michael Clark. Hey, Michael.
Great to be here, Jo. I think this is a long time coming, right? So really looking forward to this.
Yeah, me too. Absolutely. So let's start with a quick intro into who you are.
Yes, absolutely. So Michael Clark, as you say, I have a day job. So I work for MasterCard. I head up digital strategy and transformation, but I also wear another hat. I look at the future of data and the future of value, which are two of the topics and many others we're going to discuss today. This is the basis of a book that I'm writing, which is called The Data Revolution, The New Currency View. So I spend a lot of my time advising C-suites, governments, and so on what that future could look like and what does that mean, as well as obviously engaging with people like yourself and others to really start changing the narrative.
Awesome. And you're in Dubai?
I'm in Dubai. This was a move I made, I think, less than 12 months ago, a conscious choice, because it started to feel like Silicon Valley had moved. And there was a big push in terms of digital and now the data conversation. So yeah, it was a very conscious choice to be around innovation on a daily basis.
Yeah, definitely. There's so much exciting stuff happening in Dubai and in the UAE around this topic. So thank you firstly for dialing in so late in the day to do this podcast. But also secondly, because, you know, Michael and I actually were at the same event in Dubai, the Dubai Future Forum. And there was this really distinct moment where it was end of day two, you were leaving and I was talking to someone and I was like, oh, dang, I really want to say hello to Michael. So thankfully we managed to catch up, not in person in real life, but virtually afterwards. So I was really, really inspired by the things that you said at your panel around value and how you were reframing how people should even think about what data is, what value is. So these things are kind of relatively conceptual ideas, but still very tangible. I think a lot of people associate things like data or value to very, very real tangible things that you can own and control and that dictate kind of the means of your life. But I like how you talk about them as being more almost theoretical, conceptual things that maybe we haven't fully grasped yet. So I was hoping we could start there.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I literally had this conversation in LA a couple of days ago. When we think of data, I take it back to the very beginning and ask people the question, you know, what does data mean? Do you know what it actually means? And quite often you get a blank look on their face. And the word data actually comes from Latin, datum, which means gift, ironically. And it wasn't until 17th century did someone start defining it as a statistic. And then the advent of computing in the 50s, all of a sudden it was cast iron, it is a statistic. It's measurable and it's more of a byproduct of transaction. So it was almost through the ages, we kind of saw it as a byproduct of a transaction. Whereas now I'm trying to reframe it back to say, well, actually, this is a form of value. Because what is data really? It's our memories and our stories. It's every interaction we have on a daily basis. I think the reason it coexists with value is because we've lost sight of what value is, we freely give away this gift without actually really understanding what we're giving away. Because the irony is data on its own is meaningless. It's only when you derive value from it does it become meaningful, which is what some of the big tech companies figured out in the 90s when the internet became a thing. In some respects, that's when we really lost the gift, which is data, which was, again, the basis of the conversation at the Future Foundation was looking at value in a very different way, as in almost resetting things and saying, well, what is actually value? But then in turn, what is even data? And I would even argue, what is even identity? Because those three building blocks have been separated. And when they've been brought back together, it's almost like a puzzle that doesn't almost make sense. For me, identity is who you are and data is your identity. And then value is something of worth. And it's really interesting when we start to think about the transition to the digital age, a lot of those truths that we know suddenly don't really fit in the world that we're moving to, because they come from an era where we made widgets and an industrial age but we've never really stepped back and gone, are we measuring the right things? Are we looking at the right things? And it's like, I think it's becoming more relevant now because of AI, because it's forcing us to rethink a lot of things.
And it's really interesting what you touched on before around how even like companies and brands and the ones that you consult are rethinking some of these concepts as well, based on how they're changing in the world. I guess that sparked a question for me, which was, do you feel like there is a difference between the way that a receiver and a provider view these things because their intentions are different?
Yeah, I think it's very true. Because the receiver value in some cases is it's buried behind an experience. So you freely give things away, but it's almost like a mirage, right? It's like the provider of value is actually not providing the transparent value that is really there. It's almost like, hey, you see on Facebook, right? Let me see what I look like when I'm 60 years of age, and everybody piles in and gives their data away, because really the provider doesn't want to give you that experience. They want the data you're providing as part of the experience. So it's almost like a mirage. So for you as the receiver, yes, you're getting value, but the real value underneath is being taken away from you to deliver an experience to you. So there's this real disconnect of transparency, because in writing the book, I realized that I had to go back before the industrial age and really start to understand the basis of value. And there are some fundamental truths that have been lost, in the sense that when we think about giving, your question is fantastic, by the way, because it really gets to the core of what is intrinsic value versus extrinsic value, right? Because me as the receiver, I hold a set of values, and the provider holds a completely different set of values, because typically that's based on price. Whereas me as the receiver in the days before the Industrial Revolution, that may have been on uniqueness, that may have been on reputation, that may have been on simple things like the age of an artifact or an asset, or even how personal it is to me or the environment. So it's very, very different. And I think the thing that I would add on to that then that makes it more interesting, when we say the receiver and a provider, we're thinking about the world today. There is a set of customers we've not met yet, which has a different perspective on receiver and provider, because they're almost unknown to them. They are having a mindset that was before the industrial age. And they're also including other values that we don't consider, but are now becoming the way that companies are judged, which is ethics, sustainability, trust, and transparency.
Yeah, that's a really interesting avenue to go down, with particularly the value that you're standing for and ascribing to, and then how that's perceived by people. So I want to come back to that, but I just want to go back to, you know, when you said that you're doing a lot of research for the book that you're writing at the moment, and you've gone back in history. So I read this, I forget what it's called. It's an economics book for dummies, basically. It's like a cartoon that basically explains, you know, where economics started and trade and the economic models that we have, which are like relatively outdated, perhaps. So in going back, how have you seen the perception or the value of economic trade shift over time based on the platforms and the economies that enable them?
I love this question, because it was the aha moment as I went through the book, because I had to go back to the very origins of money, and I had to go back to the origins of how actually humans traded. And it's really interesting, because you get to a point where we suddenly became accountants, and the whole world started measuring everything like a balance sheet, right? So now it was not about the uniqueness of an artifact, it was about bulk, right? Uniformity. So how do I make something the same so I can sell masses of it? Whereas back before then, it was all about people would almost trade value to value even. So it's almost like, well, you have something valuable, I have something valuable, I value both sides of it, why don't we just trade, right? Because now it's one-on-one basis. But then as we then hit the Industrial Revolution, economic theory kicked in more formally, and that's when we defined GDP, by the way, because up until once we hit the Industrial Age, there was no real consistent way of measuring economies. So once we then figured out, okay, we need a way of measuring GDP, the common measure then became productivity and efficiency. So it's like, okay, that's great, but what about all the other values that we think about more broadly? So if you speak to economics people or economists, we've never been able to measure the impact of technology on labor metrics, because they're normally buried because a human being is still operating the machine. So as a labor level, you just get this labor number. With AI, that's going to change the game because now AI will be the labor force. So the question is, as we start rolling out AI, what are we now going to start measuring? Because it's no good having 100% productivity and efficiency when we're damaging the environment as a set of values, or the actual sentiment of society is miserable, right? So I think as I went through the ages going back, I found a period where things were traded based on their actual value. So value was more than just price. It was a collection of things, and it was sold on the uniqueness of things. And then as we then hit the industrial age, it just became, as I say, it just became uniformity and scale and productivity and efficiency. And then you put in the brand component and everything else. And now we're in a world where a bottle of water will cost me 50 cents in one place and $4 based on where I'm actually standing versus the value of the core product itself and its uniqueness. So we lost that through the age. And then when you put your data lens on, data actually, if you're doing it properly, aligns itself more to what it was. Uniqueness, historical age, the meaning to you. So it's really interesting when you start combining those things and you go backwards and then you go forwards.
In particular, the point around GDP, I think, is just a really, really interesting one in the context of some of the changing conversations around whether we should be assigning our success to GDP growth. I mean, this is how we measure markets. And it was so striking to me that during the pandemic, the only way that we were measuring recovery back to normal was GDP growth versus like all of the adjacent onflowing effects that we weren't measuring. And in the context of that, what you mentioned around assigning a true cost to things like a bottle of water or a gallon of oil, the cost of that goes into actually producing it, the value assigned to the output of it and what it generates for people and for societies. So do you feel like that is actually changing, or is that just something that we talk about in circles?
Is it changing? I think, look, the conversation is happening. I also think there's another part of society that are coming through which has a different perspective on the world. If you ask a child today, they don't want a single person to win. They want everybody to win. It's a completely different mindset almost. It's come from the fact that they play in communities in virtual worlds, and it's a community mindset, not an individual mindset. So I think the value piece will change. I don't think it's moving enough, if I'm being honest, because if I look at the AI conversation, we're still stuck in the mindset of tools, right? Everything is still about a tool. Nothing has changed. Because all AI is just an intelligent version of software. So that means we still are thinking in tools. Every conversation is about the tool, not the thing that powers the tool. And we still don't look at the world through convergence. Because when we applied rules to technology before, we were able to look at them as singular things. Now AI combines with quantum. Now AI combines with other technologies. So we can't just govern things in their isolation. Like, for example, if you deploy AI, who's looking at the economic models that then will need to change as a consequence of our new labor force, right? Mm-hmm. So I think and this comes from the mindset of still thinking like accountants and managing balance sheets. It's almost like we have to change the way that we think about the world, almost going back to first principles and asking some very difficult questions, which is, you know, what is identity? Because identity now is a form of social proof. It's not just a protection thing. What is data itself? Is it actually property? And ultimately then, what is value itself? I think these are conversations which are, like I say, happening, but not to the level where they need to be, given where the technology is going, right?
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like a part of that is that we think that the average everyday person is maybe more advanced in their thinking on some of these things than they are? And I say that because, you know, a few years ago, there was this huge conversation around data privacy and ownership of your own data and protection of it. And then it feels like everyone went, you know, it's not that important to people. People don't care. Like, they're happy to trade off their information for ease and convenience and these things. But maybe it's that their knowledge base, their literacy, their data literacy is actually quite low, which we know that it is. And so we're making a lot of assumptions around what is actually right for people versus what we think that they're actually wanting.
Yeah, no, I think it's a fair question. But then it all comes back to, what do they know, right? They don't know what they don't know right now. You know, you've got companies, if I was to tell them, hey, if let's just say a town, a city of a country of 8 million people, 90% penetration, every single person sold a piece of data for $5, that's $25 million a day. Right? So what if I told them that if you had your data and you sold it, by the time you were 90, based on 1.7 meg of data we create per second per day, you'd make $16 million. How would you feel about that? It's because the conversation is not being framed in the right way. If we turned the if we turned the dial and went, let's have a value conversation with you, right? Because this is actually your property. And do you realize you're missing out on probably your greatest asset, which is, you know, if you would added up all the data we create, and if everybody lived until 90 years of age, that's 65 million football stadiums full of 70,000 people per stadium. And if you equated a value to that, people could literally retire at birth if that data was handed down to them. So I think it's because it's buried behind software and hardware, particularly software and experiences, and people just don't value it the same as a commodity then. Because if you said to someone, would you give all your gold away? They would say no. But ironically, data carries the same characteristics as gold if you look at it from a commodity to a commodity perspective.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I don't think many people would think of it that way.
If you think about it today, the Googles of this world make, particularly Alphabet, make hundreds of billions of dollars based on the data we provide, not all of it, but a large proportion of it, from an advertising revenue and so on. And in return, we get more storage and we might get some games to play if we're on Facebook or other platforms. So it's, you know, what's the value return here?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, with this first-party data ownership kind of ambition that a lot of organizations have, and, you know, a lot of companies want to create a larger platform for themselves to be able to have a customer base that they can tap into, you know, once a day. Let's say an organization that has 65 million customers coming through their stores. I mean, that's a huge avenue to directly reach your customers. But in building that out, what do you see as being kind of the big, you know, gap that people have in their strategy or in their planning and really thinking through future-proofing this kind of ambition?
Yes. So in the book, by the way, I touch on this in every chapter. I lay out what a government has to do and a business needs to do. So I have this conversation a lot, is that we store stuff that we just don't need. Like if you go back, a lot of these questions came up in pockets through history, right? There was, I think, I forget the date, but someone made a statement in an American paper in the 40s and 50s and said, what are we going to do with all this data that's being created from computers, right? So someone said something and thought, hang on, what are we going to do with all this, right? But they asked the wrong question. It's like they should have said, how do we know what the value is and which bit should we be keeping, right? So if you think about it, we wouldn't need so much storage in the world if we really understood the value in our data, mm-hmm. right? Because literally, if we looked at our data like liquidity, that's what we should be doing. And the trouble is, the companies that are going to thrive when ownership kicks in, believe it or not, is a mixture of having the right infrastructure to do that, because you're going to have data for a very short period of time. Because I'm going to lend it to you based on how long I'm prepared to give it to you, which means you've got about 10, this is why AI is going to do the work for you, right? Because you're not going to be able to gather all this insight and then make a decision in the time frame that I may decide that you have. So there's a technology component that needs to be in place to be able to do this and a workforce to make that happen. But then there's another piece of the puzzle that we must not forget, that you may have the best infrastructure in the world, but if I don't think you're an ethical business, I'm not giving you my data.
Right.
So we can talk about all the infrastructure in the world. If I don't think you operate in the way that I don't think you're sustainable, I don't think you're transparent, I don't like the way that you engage me for a business perspective, you're not getting my data. So I think there's definitely a technology lens, because one is a skills and a talent gap. The two is legacy is still a problem. So people still don't really know where their data is if you ask them. And there's a layer that's always been missing, which is, okay, I've got it in a data lake and I've stored it, but then what do I do with it now I have it, right? And more importantly, what should I even be storing in the first place? Because you don't want to be in a situation where it's like the old T-shirt in the wardrobe, I'm keeping it just in case. The only data you should be really keeping is like liquidity on hand. Well, you know, I see something in the universe, I need it, I'm going to get it. Because the retail example is a great one, because not many people, I don't think, have realized this, is when Apple launched their glasses, for the first time in human history, we can store human emotion as a data set. Right? Gesture cues now are a data set. Spatial technology is now a data set. How I feel is a data set. So this is why ownership is even more important, because let me give you an example of what I mean by that. Today, everybody wears an Apple Watch or some form of smartwatch, right? If my temperature rises, typically the watch is going to go, you should probably go and see a doctor or consult XYZ, right? No context. It just knows that my heart has risen. If I was wearing glasses, it would know that I've just looked at my phone bill and I can't pay it. So my heart has risen, right? So now I've combined non-verbal data, which is most of our communication, with contextual data and everything else. And all of a sudden, I've got a different picture. Now, maybe my independent financial advisor appears in front of me and says, would you like a loan for the period of time? So as we start piecing this puzzle together, there's a danger that we give more away than we have today. So that's why I keep going back to your example. For the retailers, they're going to struggle probably because they're not thinking in the right way about data and the technology. But then the next question is, I would think more about how you're perceived outwardly for not me as a customer, but the customer you've not met yet.
The ethics piece, I think, is really, really important. It touches on the other point that you made around younger consumers and the next generation and what they're going to be expecting happens with their data or data, and how they assign value to things, which you touched on this before, but the kind of the sharing economy aspect of younger people where, you know, maybe I don't need to own everything. Maybe I can borrow it when I need it or use what I need or share it and share in a profit scheme even. And that's where, you know, this concept of the decentralized economies kind of comes in, which is a really exciting area. And it's kind of, I don't know, there's a really interesting conversation in the industry around whether this is something that we want, but that actually is just not feasible. I mean, is it actually feasible when we live currently in a capitalist society where we need to generate money and we do have an unequal wealth distribution? So someone has to profit more than somebody else. So is this a nice idea and a nice to have and a dream, or do you feel like this is actually happening?
I think it's happening. So a great example is a data union in Web3, where people just pool all their data together into almost like a mini DAO or a pool, and a smart contract then will sell that on an exchange and everybody's rewarded. In the book, I outline as an entire chapter on data as a financial instrument. So I talk about data bonds, data equities, data ETFs, even data savings products. The other example I use in the book is value to value. So the example I give is, imagine two people in the world have diabetes, right? So one person is managing their diabetes through the traditional way of medication. The other is doing it with their diet. Both are doing reasonably well, but they decide, actually, maybe we could learn from each other. Let's just swap. Let's just swap our data sets and plug it into our device. And all of a sudden, could those two people with both of their knowledge suddenly push that data back into the ecosystem for a research agency to buy and acquire? And with an AI, and who knows, could we cure a disease? So the model itself, look, there will always be a financial aspect to this because people will swap and exchange and there will be a monetary reward. But I think, look, the writer of my last chapter, Brett King, talks heavily about, you know, whether capitalism is actually right for the world that we're moving to.
Right.
It's a big debate worth having, because it feels like the world is fracturing in front of us in different corners of the world, unfortunately. But you look at it and you're looking then at the digital mindset and the consumer of tomorrow, which is why you have to go back to value and say, look, is our view of value completely skewed? Like the most important asset we've got in our lifetime is planet Earth, but yet we're too busy worried about how much it costs to fix it. Mm-hmm. So it's almost this muddied mindset. So look, I think there will be, in some of the data products I describe, they will use some of the technologies from Web3, obviously. There will be decentralized aspects and they will also be centralized. I think that has to be accepted, because certain things will have to be centralized for the very nature of them. But I think there will be examples, and there are, right? There's digital communities that exist already where people are prepared to share and so on. I think you've touched on a word which we really need to solve, which is inclusion. We've never solved it for financial services, really, because of the network coverage. What is really interesting with data is the Skylink, the Elon Musk satellite version of the internet, where they're able to turn on connections at will. I think as we go through the ages, I think data and other forms of currency will break that inclusion barrier. And I think some of the core, what I would call next generation technologies, which we associate with decentralization, will play a bigger part than people realize.
I think what's really refreshing is that, like, I'm clearly talking to a futurist, because you're not necessarily ascribing what is right or what is wrong. You're asking questions and you're kind of probing what currently is the system in play versus what you see emerging and that's coming. And one of the things that I think is really interesting is, you know, some of these new models of economics or economic models like cryptocurrency, blockchain, were created around the same time as when the first iPhone came out. So these things are not, like, they're pretty new, and I think they're assessed maybe by people who are less close to them as being, you know, like a fad or highly volatile or like evolving at a very rapid pace. But then when you compare them to something like the iPhone, which is just a smartphone that is a staple of our lives, but it has gone through these evolutions, it's interesting to think about how people might be navigating from a mental or an emotional perspective some of these concepts that are very foreign to them, that feel very volatile. So how do you provide some sense of guidance or stability around some of these things that feel uncertain for people?
I'm a huge believer in storytelling, because I think if you tell a story that puts someone in the story that they can relate to, it grounds it a little bit, right? I think I'm always the optimist. I always look at the world through very optimistic eyes. So it's telling powerful and meaningful stories. And what you said about the iPhone is exactly right, because what people probably don't realize is AI was created about the same time as the first computer. Mm. So the time frames are pretty much the same. So you had hardware and software and AI all being developed at the same time, which is why we see this convergence, right? I talk about this so often, that it was the convergence of all of these technologies through the ages, VR, AR, machine learning, AI. These aren't things that just fell off a bus and suddenly we were able to have the metaverse. These are years and years in the making. But we have a duty of care almost to tell a story and an explanation that people understand and put themselves in, but also it's relatable. Because I think, look, some of these concepts, I'm sure we've all seen the videos of poor people in the Senate trying to be explained by a 12-year-old what blockchain is, right? Or some developer. And sometimes it's incredibly painful to watch. But we have a duty of care, I think, of when you know stuff, you have a duty of care to give back. And I think we should do that in meaningful stories and the way that we describe it. And I think the other thing that we have a duty of care of is to work with regulators and governments to give them the insight that they may not have. Because it's unfair for them to really understand all these technologies now they can buy. Because I think one of the biggest failings is if you go back through that historical timeline I've described, there's one glaring miss. Not a single regulator was involved in any of that research. They were only involved when the button was pushed and it was deployed in the mainstream, and it was often too late. So a lot of the things that we need to help the people think about tomorrow is making sure that we work with regulators so they now remain on the front foot. And they're involved in some of this early research and this understanding in partnership with people like us and people like you and other technologists and others who can bring them that broader perspective and join the dots for them and then ask those critical questions so the regulator then can educate the consumer and people like us then can tell meaningful stories and guide people. I love the quote that, I can't remember who said it, I think it was someone from Salesforce. It's almost like our job is to meet our customers in the future when they arrive, knowing that we solved everything for them. We solved the identity problem, we solved the data problem, because we're the ones that ask the difficult questions, but at the same time, we're able to explain it in a way that everybody can understand.
Yeah, and that's so valuable, sorry to use that word, not flippantly, but it's so valuable when we think about private organizations trying to create new technologies for some of these things that potentially regulators or governments don't understand. So you're almost making your life easier by, you know, bringing them up to speed and getting them on the same page so that when you're creating the next iteration, they're aligned with you and they can see the benefit. So on that point that you made around duty of care, I think this is really interesting, particularly for someone like yourself, who is more public, more in the public space, even though you do work for MasterCard and you're writing your book. When's the book out?
Some point this year. Great. So I'm getting close. I have a few chapters to go. It's what's fascinating with the book is every day you're waking up, because this is kind of 4 years in the making, believe it or not. I wrote the first paper on this 3 years ago. And in writing it, the air came out the room because I realized I was defining an entire economy. Nice. So it's almost like as you keep going, you end up creating things that don't exist, or you end up combining things and re-bringing things back into the domain of conversation. So it is it's a labor of love.
It's can't imagine.
That way. But my hope with all of it is, as I said, with the storytelling, is that it's there to guide and help people and navigate as we go through. But yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And over the last 4 years, as you've been writing it, I imagine that you've had a lot of pivots throughout where you've been maybe influenced by the evolution in the world and like AI, for example, going deeper on that, or maybe not.
Do you know, yes and no. So the only thing I think that became clearer was the puzzle. So in the book, I outline an entire model of how all this will work. So I define something called a data ecology, which is basically a multi-level model where data and identity sits at the heart of it, which is yours. We'll see emergence of a super wallet where you'll manage all of this. And then there's a layer, which is where data gets translated into value, which is where all the next generation businesses live. And then data will be passed around in ownership through a value ecosystem and then managed by various parties. So a lot of the time to that point was figuring out what that model actually is. So unfortunately, when you start writing this stuff, you get halfway through and you go, ah. And you meet a lot of people as well. Yeah. So I met a lot of incredibly interesting people. Like I was really fortunate to the people building the world's first digital clearinghouse in London for the digital pound, because I wanted to know if I could collateralize data and run it on an exchange. And the answer was yes. The world doesn't stop, which is why I appear on podcasts like this to sort of keep the narrative going. But then in the same time, to your point, there is a point, though, where you have to go enough's enough. Like the world's moving too much. But as long as the model holds true, and what I'm saying for governments and leaders to think about, and particularly how to do it, still holds true. Because the most important thing is not about, yes, I described the technologies, because it's not a technology book. It was never meant to be. This was a big aha as well, is how we move from historical data to real-time data, running on real-time AI. Because whether we like to admit it or not, history is littered with bias before even AI was created. Right. So we have to rethink, because history is just something somebody else wrote in a moment in time. It's been proven through the ages, even in COVID, that our data contains bias. So there is a role for AI, absolutely, but there's also a cautionary tale.
Yeah. I mean, our memories contain bias, right? So it's such a human element that has to be captured into that future data ecosystem that you're building. It's really interesting. Can't wait to read about that. One thing that you mentioned in there around the super wallet. Mm. So I'm curious, do you look at more advanced markets like China as an indicator for where the future might be headed on some of these things? Or do you think that they're so structured around a cultural norm that it's not replicable for the rest of the world?
I actually went to see in my writing, this was very painful because of the distance. I went to Silicon Valley for 48 hours. To meet one of the world's first data wallets in Silicon Valley, where they're actually building a data wallet, which I've not seen at all anywhere else. What was also interesting in the research was that something China did last year, which is Element X, which is the next evolution of their digital strategy, which is all about data. They're literally doubling down on data. So given the breadth and depth of wallets in China already, it wouldn't surprise you if data was moved around. Obviously, there are cultural norms where maybe ownership may not happen, but data will be moved around. And they're looking at increasing the economy by around about 20% just based on data as a fuel. But no, I think the reason I use the word super wallet is because it'll be a collection of currencies. It'll be a collection of things. It won't just be your data eventually in 10, 15 years' time. It might start with data, but it might be something else. As a collection, so your fractional ownership, it might be your identity, it might be various other aspects as well. The signs are there, and as you said, from a futurist perspective, I always make the joke, you know, we're not fortune tellers, we just follow signals. And if you kind of look at the signals of where wallets are going, it's finally starting to hit Europe as a concept. And I think, you know, the signs are there in other markets outside of China that these wallets are starting to emerge, or at least the early prototypes and designs of them.
Mm. Yeah, it's really exciting to think about where this is headed. And I'm looking forward to the book when it comes out, which probably explains a lot of these concepts that I absolutely butchered in this conversation. So thank you. Thank you.
That was fine. They are there. And I've kept them again. Like, I always joke, I've written it like The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, because I wanted to make it entertaining and not like it, but with facts, right? That's and make great. It storytelling. But yes, I do describe them, but I've kept, like, for example, I describe blockchain without using the word blockchain.
Yeah, great.
I describe it as more of a digital ledger, which is what it is, right? So the layman can understand.
That's great.
Or anybody, quite frankly, it doesn't really matter. So no, it is all described in there. And it's been really interesting to see how all these dots line up in the research of it, but also then being able to be practically doing it day to day as well. So I always make the joke, I'm writing this from an industry experience, having lived data for so long in an industry standpoint, and then being able then to put another lens on that, I think brings an element of reality and realism to it rather than somebody just having a conceptual opinion.
Yeah, definitely. Or without it feeling dry, to your point, because ultimately these stories are about people and the future is about us as humans. So I think it's, you know, based on everything that you're saying, it's a very compelling case for us all to get more interested in data, value, economies, ownership, and these topics that you covered. And the book will be a great way to do that. So that leads me beautifully to my last question, which is, what do you do when you're trying to get yourself familiar with a completely different topic or a space, or just get yourself out of the head of everything that you do day to day?
I think we talked about this before we started recording, and I think I'm going to give the same answer as everybody else. Just get outside. Mm-hmm. Like there are so many days where, like, I have my writing spaces, like every writer, I suppose. Ironically, mine's a plane. I don't know why. Brett King's is a coffee shop. It's just like we all have our thing. Mm. But I think getting outside does something to you. It's almost like the Steve Jobs effect, right? You go outside and suddenly things become a little bit clearer. And sometimes, do you know what? I will just stop. And sometimes you can't force something. And that's why walking outside helps as well, because now you're in a different space and you're thinking slightly differently. My mind is a horrible place because you're constantly thinking and joining Lego bricks and combining things. And sometimes you just need to get out of your own way. And sometimes a bit of nature and a bit of walking and just family time. Actually, ironically, family time does that as well, because actually you start thinking about something completely different. And then I'm terrible then, because then you'll get the answer. Then suddenly you're over dinner and you're like, oh my God, I figured it out. But no, I think it's a mixture of just getting out of your head, getting into some fresh air and maybe spending time with family gives me that release to then think of something different, which then has a weird effect of bringing it back to what you were thinking about, but then you can look at it in a different way.
I think we often forget that actually stopping what you're doing might be the most productive thing that you can do for whatever it is that you're working on.
Yes, very much. I think that you can, you know, keep flogging a dead horse as long as you want. But sometimes it's like, look, do you know what? I think it's time I stopped. Even if it's a case of downing tools for an entire day and just giving your brain a rest, particularly if you're writing constantly, to stop and just do nothing and be comfortable with doing nothing, things will come again. But it's just having the confidence to stop and then just recharge and then go again.
Yeah, definitely. And that's something that you have to do intentionally and make time for. So it's a good reminder for us all to do that. So Michael, thank you for all of the insights that you shared. It's such an interesting area to explore and look forward to reading more about it in the book. But in the meantime, thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're more welcome. It's a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, or share the show, and I will see you next time. Until then, keep looking outside.